Hey friends, well, let's get back to it here. So I guess first thing, there's a lot of notes here. I'm not 100% sure we're going to make it through all of it. May skip through some places, but I wanted to give you more notes rather than fewer notes because I think some of the details may be helpful. I think I put a little bit of a warning on the front end of this. It should be relatively self-explanatory given the topic, but this one is going to be fairly explicit. So if that's not something you want to sign up for, there's another great session straight above us here. But we are talking about marriage sexuality, and we're talking about it in some detail there in order to be helpful. All right. So Christmas season is upon us, and that means that the Brooks household is starting to receive those catalogs that toy companies, I guess Amazon and Walmart and Target, send your way so that you can hand them to your children and your children can circle everything that they want in the catalog. Now, I think they can probably just draw a circle around the whole catalog because they go through and circle almost everything. But you know what? It keeps them busy for a little while. And Amazon's is perfect because they give you 2 pages of stickers in it, too, which is really a good thing for the little guys there. Right? You know, people love... Well, my children love Christmas half because of Jesus and half because of presents. And if I'm really honest, I think one of those probably outweighs the other in their little 6 and 4-year-old hearts. But we'll get there eventually, right? Now, sex, when talked about in the church, is oftentimes described as God's gift for human beings. Sex is a great gift from God. I think almost every sermon I've ever heard on sex makes that statement. And that statement is entirely true. I think that that's a specifically helpful notion to counter kind of ideas that sex might be inherently shameful. That those, especially kind of in yesteryear where there were more taboos about what was able to be talked about, perhaps in the context of a church, it's good to affirm that sex is actually God's idea and is not inherently dirty. I also think that such comments are helpful for individuals who maybe are coming from perhaps a more promiscuous background or something like that, in recognizing that though human beings may misuse sexuality, there's nothing in it inherently that's dirty. In fact, it's a good thing from our good Creator. Sex is ultimately God's idea, right? We see this throughout the Scriptures. One of the first things we know about human beings is that there are two genders or two sexes, and I use those two terms with an equal sign between them. 5 years ago, I wouldn't have to say that, but we'll just go ahead and throw that out there. I assume you do as well, right? The first thing we hear off of Adam's lips from their being a human female is, this is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. There's a delight in each other. One of the first things we hear is that they're naked and unashamed, is that sex is part of God's design of human beings. We see in our holy book kind of catalogs of body parts in Song of Solomon, and the sexual body parts aren't skipped. In those passages, there's an understanding that God has given sexuality to human beings and that it is a good thing. It's a gift. But sex as gift isn't necessarily everybody's experience of sex. In the words of one Christian woman I heard or I saw writing about this, she made the comment, "If sex is a gift, I think I'd like the receipt to return it, please." And sadly, that can be the experience of many people. And so in this session, I'm going to be presenting, a talk on marital sex after abuse. I want to throw a couple caveats here, okay? Because, again, I want to make sure that we understand what I'm talking about. First off, if you are currently in a abusive relationship, whether sexually or otherwise, the things that I'm going to talk about in this talk are not for you. Okay? In fact, if you were to do them, it would lead only to further harm to you. Same if you're helping someone who's in a sexually abusive or other forms of abuse relationship. This won't be helpful for them. Okay? This assumes that spouses are allies with each other one is not exploiting the other. If that's a scenario that you or someone you know is in, there are other things to be done. My colleague Jim Neuhaus has written a helpful book called Help, Someone I Love is Being Abused. I know Bo would be happy to help you walk through such things as well. What you need first and foremost is safety for you and your family. Second, this talk is also not based off of the question of what if my spouse was my sexual abuser, okay? So what do I do if my spouse is the one who is sexually abusing me? There are things in this talk that would be helpful for you, but that's not necessarily the main focus. I do want to throw one caveat here, okay? There can be abuse in marriages that's quite unwitting. So we talked yesterday about how there's that huge spectrum of abuse sometimes. And say you have that husband or wife who kind of stares at 1 Corinthians 7 and is like, you owe this to me, so let's do it. And isn't thinking of that in terms of like, I'm controlling you, I'm exploiting you. This would be helpful for you. But if you're more in that category of like a spouse was, you know, kind of engaged in just straight marital rape, and now trying to pick up the pieces after that, that's not exactly what we're looking at here. Some things might be helpful, but it's more complex. Okay, so again, Conference on Sexual Abuse, there's so many things that can be swept under here. I just want us to be clear what we're talking about. All right, so we're specifically looking at when sexual abuse from someone outside your marriage is creating trouble for you inside of your marriage. Now, why does sexual abuse trouble sexual intimacy? Why does sexual abuse trouble sexual intimacy? I think the first thing I want to note is that not everybody who has suffered sexual abuse is automatically going to suffer or is automatically going to struggle in their sex life with their spouse. Okay, so there's not necessarily a one-to-one correlation here. It's not as though, well, I was molested as a child, so therefore I'm going to have all kinds of sexual problems with my spouse. It's not a one-to-one guarantee. Does it certainly increase the likelihood? Well, certainly. But it's not a one, and that's important because perhaps you're staring at it being like, well, I don't think I have sexual problems with my spouse, but I know I was abused. Maybe I actually am having sexual troubles with my spouse. I just don't know it. No. We don't want to climb the ladder that way. Okay. Let's not create problems where there are none. Let's praise God that there are not problems because there's terribly few categories in life in which there are no problems. Right. All right. But why is it that many, I say the majority of people who suffer some form of sexual abuse do have some form of struggles with sexual intimacy? Well, the first thing we need to do is understand sex. What is sex and how has God designed sex to intersect with our personhood? How has God designed sex to intersect with our personhood? So as God has designed it, there are two aspects to sex as connects to who we are as human beings. Now, one of them is not the creation of children. That is certainly a purpose of sex, but I'm thinking about sex specifically as relates to how a husband and wife interact in marriage together. So the first kind of component of sex is intimacy. It's intimacy. One of the two main components of what's going on in sex for a married couple is intimacy. It's been well documented inside of churches that the Hebrew euphemism for having sex is to know. When you look at the Hebrew, it says in Genesis, when Adam, a lot of modern translations tend to translate it, Adam was intimate or was sexually intimate with his wife, that the Hebrew word there is actually to know. Now, we don't want to kind of put an extreme degree of stress on Hebrew euphemisms. For example, instead of saying what's his face, they say what's his nose in the Bible. So whenever you see kind of a oblique, it happens in Ruth. The fellow's name is Peloni Almoni, who refuses to buy her back. That literally means what's his nose, which is kind of awesome. Also, the Hebrew way of describing anger is his nose became hot. They got something about the nose inside the Hebrew language. So we don't want to put too much stress on this fact that, like, knowledge, knowing, is the euphemism for sex, but it does indicate something, right? It captures something. The first hint of sexuality in the Bible is one of intimacy. This is bone of my bone. This is flesh of my flesh. Adam sees Eve, his wife, and sees an intimate, deep connection with her as a person, as his wife. And later on in that passage, you'll see that directly stated as two become one flesh. Now, two becoming one flesh means certainly far more than just the physical act of sex, but it's not exclusive of that. When it's talking about two becoming one flesh, that includes the sexual act, right? Now, sex involves all kinds of intimacy. There's certainly physical intimacy, but there's other forms of intimacy that are all wrapped up in sex. You see there being a deep amount of physical nakedness, but also emotional nakedness. There's vulnerability. There's tenderness. If you think about a marital sex life, there are lots of things about your spouse that only you know, right? There's not a single person outside of your marriage that knows things related to your spouse regarding sex. Now, there can be complications to that, right? Especially if someone came from a sexual background of certainly more freedom with that. But in terms of kind of the day-to-day now, like, no one knows my wife like I do. No one knows me like my wife does. Right? And the intimacy of sexuality is really beautiful. It's really beautiful. It also explains why sexual abuse can strike so deeply into the human person, right? Sexual abuse isn't just a kind of accident that we can shake off. So I mentioned yesterday that I was recently in kind of a car accident with a deer, and it was moderately bad. But it's not the kind of thing that has this incredible cloud that's looming over the entirety of my life, right? Even now, some of the more trauma-oriented symptoms, like extreme anxiety when crawling behind a wheel, especially on a certain stretch of road, that's started to fade, and it's only about 4 weeks out. It's very different than something that is connected to sexual abuse, right? We understand that sexual abuse really strikes at the core of our personhood because sex is something that was designed to be deeply intimate. It's a violation. It's an intimate violation. It's not just an outward violation. You think of a passage like 1 Corinthians 6, 15 through 17, Paul is describing why the Corinthian church should not be visiting prostitutes. He says, anyone joins to a prostitute is one body with her. Now, that does not mean that you are one body with your sexual abuser in that same way, but I just want to mention that verse to recognize that he's speaking there of a deep connection that sex is designed to be. And so the fact that it's so wrapped around who we are as people explains some of the reason that it has such a strong impact. The other element beyond intimacy is pleasure. Sex is supposed to be, it's designed to be uniquely pleasurable as each spouse works towards the sexual pleasure and satisfaction of their other spouse, right? God could have made sex about as exciting as he made breathing. Now, in coming from the South to here, one of the things I was looking forward to is taking a breath of like really crisp and clear air that y'all have in the Pacific Northwest. Right, we have so much just humid denseness where we're at that we don't really have anything that could be described as crisp and refreshing in the air. I was really looking forward to breathing West Coast air again. And if you haven't ever been outside of this area, you don't recognize that, right? But even that's not close to, you know, the pleasure that's involved in sexuality. The fact that our culture and all sorts of cultures before us have used sexualized images to sell hamburgers, cars, and vodka shows that there's something uniquely pleasurable about sex for human beings. Human beings tend to have sex drives. There's a push towards this. And sexual abuse strikes at this mark of sex as well. And that's that sexual abuse, one, instead of mutual pleasure, sexual abuse uses a person for one's own pleasure at the expense of another, right? And so you have something that is supposed to be mutually delightful, and instead you turn it into a kind of, you turn it into something where one is exploiting the other for their own personal physical satisfaction. Violent acts of sexual abuse may cause injury. It can have physiological ramifications. Individuals who have suffered sexual assault can have all kinds of physical injuries that may lead to continued pain for various kinds of reasons. And then coercive sexual abuse or childhood sexual abuse can involve sexual pleasure for the victim, which is really confusing and can lead to guilt, right? There are some abusers who find the greatest amount of sexual satisfaction in abuse, in pleasuring the other person, not just their own pleasure, which is the flip side of what we often think of it as. But I have the ability to control your arousal, and that makes me feel powerful. That's a category of sexual abuser. And so sexual abuse strikes at both of these marks of the that are part of the beauty of God's good gift of sex to us. Is that sexual abuse strikes at the intimacy of sex, and it also strikes at the pleasure of sex. And that helps explain why sexual abuse that happened 20 years ago can still have significant ramifications in sex now with your spouse. Because it's one of the deepest violations of your personhood that can exist. Think of it this way. When it comes to physiology, which is actually more typically disruptive? Sexual abuse or an amputation of a limb? It's actually the amputation of a limb, right? Where you now are missing a leg or an arm or something of that nature. And yet that doesn't have as strong of a kind of personal repercussions as would being assaulted sexually. Right? One is far more tied to who we are as people. None of us in this room have any ability to experience life apart from being sexual beings. There's no generic human experience. Every human experience has to be viewed through male or female lenses. That's how God designed us. Our sexuality is not the core of our personhood, but it is essential to our personhood. Does that make sense? Okay. So, common sexual troubles after abuse. We're on that section in the notes here. And I gave you more notes than I have in my other talks, just because I want you to have this data. You may wind up talking about this with a spouse who's not here or want to reflect on it and things like that. That's why I gave you so much. All right, so sex isn't much of a taboo topic in our society today. And that's probably the case in churches as well, right? You're not going to have the majority of people be aghast at you if you preached a sermon, say, on certain passages of Ezekiel or things like that, that perhaps you might have had, 30 years ago. But even in church, we typically talk about sex in broad categories. I know what I said there, by the way, okay? I've talked to your pastor. Even that we typically talk about sex in broad categories rather than not talking about sex in terms of some of the mechanics of it. And frankly, that's probably a good thing, right? I think I mentioned yesterday, my four and six-year-old are really good at picking up the parts of sermons that I prefer for them not to pick up. They don't seem to they don't seem to have ears for mercy and treat your brother kindly and obey your parents, dang it. But they do have ears for John the Baptist's head got cut off? Or, Daddy, what's circumcision? We'll talk about it later. Right? So it's good that we don't talk about those things, perhaps from a pulpit. But we do as a church need to talk about these things. So I'm actually really excited about talking about this with you guys. The fact that we don't talk about sexual troubles much in church often can lead to people wondering exactly what's wrong with them. Right? What's wrong with me? So here are just some common sexual troubles for married couples after sexual abuse. This is from observational literature on just cataloging the kinds of suffering that happens to couples after one of them has been abused. And this is whether the abuse happened before marriage or if there, say, was a spouse who was raped in a workplace environment or something like that in the middle of marriage. So this is what human beings tend to face. Sex can feel dirty, impure, or guilt-ridden, even if one believes differently. You can believe that this is entirely pure with my husband and yet still feel just a pervasive sense of guilt, shame, anxiety, things like that. It can be an intellectual desire for sex that isn't matched by an enjoyment of sex or an inclination to actually pursue sex. Yes, I want to have sex with my wife. I want to have sex with my husband. But then when we actually go to do it, there's just no pleasure there whatsoever. Dissociation during sex. So dissociation is a little bit of a technical term. Dissociation is simply when a human being mentally isn't present in the moment. So some of you may be dissociating right now on a very mild level, and that would be your spacing out, thinking about some football games that are going on right now, or are my kids tearing up the house, or whatever it may be, right? That's kind of mild dissociation. All of us do that. That's daydreaming. But then there's more troubling forms of dissociation that in a clinical environment would be considered pathological. I'm not tied to that language at all. It's just recognizing, hey, look, these are things that are actually unhealthy, right? So dissociation during sex, it could be spacing out, intentionally distancing yourself from the acts that happen, imagining yourself somewhere else in order to get through it, or lacking memories of actually having sex with your spouse, where the memories simply are not there. Dissociation is actually one of the ways that God has designed us as human beings to protect ourselves in the middle of some kind of sexual abuse. I've read accounts of little girls who would imagine themselves riding a horse while being sexually abused so that they weren't forced with confronting what was actually happening with them. It's horrible to talk about, right? But this is what's happened to people. And so dissociation oftentimes is, you know, thinking about something else is our way of protecting ourselves from taking in all kinds of memories. That's protective when it comes to an abusive environment. But what happens when you're having sex with your spouse? Something that's meant to be mutual and delightful. The setting of sex or having sex at all can trigger anxiety, panic attacks, etc. for past memories. Sex can invite in intrusive memories, memories that you try and hold at bay, but then due to being in an environment very similar to what it was like to be sexually assaulted, those intrusive memories kind of break through your defenses and you wind up really wrestling with them. Or sex triggering involuntary fight or flight responses. Individuals can sometimes become violent during sex because they're responding out of a fight response, which is entirely appropriate when you're being sexually assaulted, but isn't exactly what you want to happen when you're having sex with your husband or wife in a loving manner, right? That can be tied with dissociation. And then lastly, painful physical conditions, such as, and I always struggle to say this word, not because it's embarrassing, because there's a lot of letters in it, vaginismus or other forms of dyspareunia, right? These would be physical muscle contractions that a woman has that can make intercourse incredibly painful or impossible to do muscle tightening. It's very, very common, especially after sexual abuse. So those are the kind of things, it's not an exhaustive list, but those are the kinds of things that couples who have had abuse at some point in their story often struggle with. So the question is, what do you do? What do you do in the midst of this? Okay, so we're going to talk for a minute about, hang on a second. we're good. I'm just not sure I can yell over that. I'm not sure I want to yell at the stuff I'm going to talk about over that. It's funny, like, when you're a parent, well, before you're a parent, you're like, oh, my gosh, why can't they keep the kids under control? And then, like, when you are a parent, you're like, oh, good, it's not mine this time. My son has defiled the Walmart with his screams over Hot Wheels cars. He learned not to do that quickly, right? Okay, so what do? It's one thing to name troubles. It's helpful to understand, you know what, these are the kinds of things that human beings suffer with, and we're not alone. One of the challenges of these things not being talked about very often, especially inside of Christian circles, is that you wind up thinking, does this actually happen to anybody else? It can be very isolating and avoid, and can lead to a lot of kind of struggles that don't need to happen. Okay, so what do? I'm going to walk through some kind of background stuff and then some very, very practical stuff. Okay, so first off, what do? Setting the stage. First thing is to recognize that you and your spouse are allies facing a shared trouble. You and your spouse are allies facing a shared trouble. So I married my wife, Caitlin Wells, who then became Caitlin Brooks, and in marrying her, I married a certain set of strengths, and I married a certain set of weaknesses. I married a certain set of like hobbies and a certain set of like not hobbies. Okay, I think I have historically been a very, very big sports fan, and I think since we got married, I've seen maybe 4 total sports games. The reason for that is that and this isn't prescriptive, this is descriptive of how we do it. My wife and I have decided that we're going to organize our lives around the things that we both enjoy, rather than kind of her doing her enjoyment and me doing my enjoyment, and that's fine. If that's how your family runs, that's totally fine. That's how we've done it. Right. Another thing I married into is the fact that we're going to be late for every single event on the face of planet Earth. Okay? My wife really fits in like Latin time or African time. She's as white as all get out. But I will tell you, that girl has not met an event that she can be late. She can't be late to. I call her the goldfish. You know how a goldfish will grow to whatever size container it's in? It does not matter. If we start getting ready 6 hours ahead of time or 20 minutes ahead of time, we're still going to be 15 minutes late. I know this because I've tried it. Right? It's terrible being married to a counselor because you're consistently someone who's being experimented on, right? Now, when I married Kate, I knew that I was importing certain troubles into my life, but I was also importing a whole lot of benefits into my life, right? My wife is someone who wears everything on her sleeve, and I love it. She's a little wrecking ball in, like, nice reform circles. My wife is an artist. She sees a lot of beauty in ways that I don't. My wife is incredibly kind in ways that I'm not naturally kind, right? She adds far more than 50% of the righteousness to my family. And I wouldn't trade her for the world. And there's also certain troubles we've imported, such as we're late to everything, which I grew up where inside the list of like things that would probably send you to hell, lateness was probably one of those things. So I've had my issues to work through, right? You know, when we marry somebody, we marry their narrative. We marry their story. And when you marry an individual who has suffered sexual abuse, you are marrying and becoming one flesh with whatever their narrative is. And that means that those problems are not their problem. The problem is your problem. Why? Because you are one flesh. Look over at Ephesians 5 real fast. Ephesians 5, 28 through 30. It's a very, very common marriage passage, but I want to look at it through the lens of sexual abuse inside of marriage. Ephesians 5:28 says, "In the same way, husbands are to love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hates his own flesh, but provides and cares for it, just as Christ does for the church, since we are members of one body. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. This mystery is profound, but I am talking about Christ and the church. To sum it up, each of you is to love his wife as himself, and the wife is to respect her husband. Okay, there's two ways that you can read this, and one of them is a terribly craven way. The craven way to read this is say, yeah, husbands need to be nice to their wives, or they'll become like super naggy and ruin their life. That's not what Paul is talking about here. Paul is saying, you are to care for your wife's flesh as your flesh, because it is your flesh. There's a mystical union inside of marriage where the boundaries become between the two people become fuzzy. And we can even back that up with the fact that the example of that is Christ and the church, right? Where there's a union there that goes beyond human language. A unbiblical approach is, this is your problem, go deal with it. This is your problem, go deal with it. No. When you marry a spouse who has been sexually abused and therefore has sexual troubles with you, these are your troubles. Plural you. Your troubles. Not her troubles, not his troubles. The biblical approach is to say, this is our problem to deal with as we walk together as husband and wife before God. This is our trouble. Now, this goes both ways. The spouse who is, say, struggling with sex is, let me say that a different way. The spouse who has suffered sexual abuse, we'll just say that they really struggle with, they really struggle with the act of sex because of memories that it can bring up, right? And so it's fraught to even have sex together. Well, that is a trouble that then produces troubles in the spouse who wasn't abused, right? As, I'm sorry, I'm really having trouble having sex with you, can very easily be interpreted as personal rejection, can't it? It can very easily lead to sexual frustration. And both spouses, when they're allies, don't view the other's struggles as threats, right? And so, again, just to use the stereotypical example, a wife who is struggling to engage in sex with her husband is able to communicate with her husband, it's not you. It's sex that's confusing. And I want this, and I'm struggling with it. And a husband can say to his wife, I am not frustrated with you. It's tempting to feel it as personal rejection. But that's because of what sex represents. And I'm struggling in those ways. And the spouses, because they're allies, realize that their focus is mutually on helping each other with the problem. Their spouse themselves isn't the problem. The spouse themselves aren't the problems. So what are some action steps? Well, the first thing is to talk about your struggles, not to blame or to accuse. Share why it's difficult, right? Throw this in another category. Throw it in the category of in-law relationships. Some of you have really good in-law relationships. Some of you have more fraught in-law relationships. Isn't it helpful for one spouse to be able to sit down with the other spouse and share how they struggle with in-laws and yet it not be guilty or accusatory? It's rather simply being heard. Like, look, I struggle with this. This is hard. These are why. And yet I'm in it. I'm not cutting these relationships off, but I need you to understand. Here's why I'm struggling in some things. Marital communication is essential for a healthy sex life. I think you also want to talk about your successes, right? Share what God is teaching you through these troubles. If for the spouse whose spouse is struggling, let's see, I'm going to use some language here in consistent ways. For the survivor's spouse, right? Everybody locked in what that means? Survivor's spouse. Okay. For the survivor's spouse, share with your spouse how God is teaching you to love selflessly, to be sacrificial, to be self-controlled, which is a fruit of the Spirit. For the survivor, share about how God is working in your heart to try and help grow love for your husband and trust that your husband is not angry with you, things of that nature. I think you affirm your love for each other and your desire to be a blessing to each other. And you avoid making demands of each other. All right, we want to talk here for a second about a particular passage, 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Flip over there. This is just one of these passages that we need to briefly mention. because this is a passage that gets kind of mixed up a lot. Look at, all right, guys, I didn't write down the exact reference. Where's the verse I'm looking for? This is what happens when you bring your electronic Bible instead of your paper Bible. You forget exactly where it is. Yeah, okay, there we go. Four, thanks, Bill. Well, let's look at three. Two. Says, but because sexual immorality is so common, each man should have sexual relations with his own wife, and each woman should have sexual relations with her own husband. A husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife, and likewise a husband to, or wife to her husband. A wife doesn't have the right over her own body, but her husband does. In the same way, a husband does not have right over his own body, but his wife does. Do not deprive one another, except when you agree, for a time, to devote yourselves to prayer. Then come together again, otherwise Satan may tempt you because of your lack of self-control. All right. Now, there's a phrase in here that's oftentimes thrown into the mix of this, which is, do not deprive one another. Now, we have to understand that there's a lot of sections of the Bible that are kind of written in a all things being equal kind of way. It's a little scary to talk about, but we have to. Is it proper for the people of God to bow before pagan idols? No. And yet, the prophet Elisha permits Naaman to do so in the Old Testament. Is it right for unconsecrated individuals to eat the consecrated loaves of bread in the Old Testament? No. And yet David is permitted to do so, and is actually used as an example of righteousness. Is lying permissible? No. But then the midwives are blessed for lying. We need to understand that the Bible is oftentimes is written in a kind of all things being equal sense. So here's how we can know this do not deprive thing. The only reason that the text specifically says that you are permitted to not be having sex as a couple is by mutual consent to prayer. What if there's physical trouble that prevents you from having sex because of extreme pain to the other? The Bible doesn't technically say can't do it. What about a military deployment? You're depriving. Does that then mean that you are in violation of God's law? No. Okay? This verse cannot be used to justify one spouse saying, you owe me this sex because God says so. If one spouse is deeply struggling through sex because of sexual abuse issues, it's wrong for them to say, can't do it, never, no, shut the door. If that's the case, then it's time to involve some other folks to be of help. But if a spouse is struggling in a moment-by-moment kind of thing, this passage cannot be used to say, you must have sex with me. Does that make sense? You know, it's interesting. The point of the passage isn't, wives, have sex with your husband. The point of the passage is that your body is not yours, but is your spouse's for their pleasure. Right? A husband's body is a wife's, and a wife has absolute ability to say, I don't want that body having sex with me right now. This is one of these passages that kind of gets mixed up that way. We oftentimes, the first half of the verse is quoted, but not the second half. Yes, the wife's body is the husband's, but the husband's body is also the wife's. Okay? So second, I want to keep moving here so we don't run out of time. Second, so the first thing in setting the stage is you and your spouse are allies facing a shared trouble. When you see each other as friends and allies, it changes the temperature in the struggle against sexual troubles. Second is to cultivate an atmosphere of love and care for your spouse. Right? Sex and intimacy are deeply intertwined, but sex is not the only form of intimacy. Right? Sex is not abstracted from your relationship with your spouse. You know, there are some cultural phrases that kind of capture this a little bit. You may have heard the cultural phrase, sex starts in the kitchen. See that in the occasional premarital book that I'll read. You know, what it's trying to say is, look, husband, do dishes. And if you do dishes, your wife is more likely to want to have sex with you because you cleaning up around the house is a turn on for her. Well, that may or may not be true. But it's or for women, you'll see the way to a man's heart is through his stomach, right? To compel women to make tasty food for men. Right. There's an understanding that the things we do are connected to intimacy. Sex just isn't a scheduled activity on Friday night or whatever, but it's deeply tied to your relationship with each other throughout the day, week, and month. And so the good news for that is that one of the pieces of helping grow in sexual intimacy with your spouse is to grow in intimacy in other areas, in other ways. And so some action steps here, taking a genuine interest in each other's cares and concerns. You know, have consistent times to talk of conversation and connection. Talk about your spouse's failures, joys, concerns. As you build a relationship with your spouse, you are helping what's going to be happening in the bedroom. Another thing is to defer to your spouse's preferences. Okay, I'm a thoroughgoing complementarian. That's the same as most Reformed folks. And yet, inside of my marriage, in almost all non-essential things, I defer to my wife's desires. If we have extra money that's laying around at the end of the month or whatever, I want to use it towards the projects that she prioritizes. If we're going out to eat, I want her choices and her preferences to govern where we go and not mine. If we're going to do like a date night or event, I want to prioritize what she wants to do rather than what I want to do. And the reason for this is that I want her to know that my general kind of orientation towards her is to sacrifice my desires for her benefit. I want her to know that for me, her desires come above my own. Okay. So if you want to help, one of the ways you can help your spouse is, you know, pay attention to what your spouse loves, what makes them laugh or light up. Team up on projects together. Do a puzzle together. Do a board game together. Choose a movie because your spouse likes it. Prioritize your spouse's interests with your discretionary income. All of this is demonstrating a love and care and concern for your wife, which builds intimacy. You know, actively involve yourself in parenting. Change diapers. Watch the kids at the end of a hard work day or whatever it may be, right? And then third, consider your sex life connected to Christ. Having sex with your spouse isn't disconnected from Christ's lordship and your sanctification. And that means that a way you care for your spouse is by turning to Christ with your own frustrations and troubles. It means being patient with your spouse when they sin against you. Friends, is there going to be sin in this category? Yes. Will spouses become impatient with each other? Will they become angry with each other? Yes. What do we do as Christians? We repent of our sins and seek forgiveness. You confess your sins and extend forgiveness. Okay, so kind of setting the stage, sex cannot be abstracted from the rest of our lives, right? So the more that you can do to build intimacy with your spouse outside of the bedroom is going to help the abuse-surviving spouse inside of the bedroom, and it's going to help the survivor spouse as well. Okay, so what do we do, like, moving forward? So turning to sex itself, what are ways that we can help? Okay. The first thing is retraining your thoughts and affections. All of us have a narrative running through our heads. We have thoughts that are running through our heads every moment of every day. And Romans 12:2 assures us that we can be transformed by the renewing of your mind. So when it says mind there, it's not just our thinking abilities. That word refers, it's a synonym for heart inside the Bible, or soul. It refers to the entirety of our inner person. We're to be transformed by the renewing of our inner person. So what does it look like? Well, action steps for a survivor. One thing that is helpful is to meditate on God's view of you having sex with your spouse. Okay? You know, Bo prayed yesterday that we would be able to think God's thoughts after him. And one of the things that God uses to help transform us slowly is by our hearts being settled in his teaching. And so if sex seems like something that is dirty or impure, one of the things that can be helpful is to simply soak your heart in the biblical passages about sex. Now, does that mean that troubles go away like that? No. Instead, it's the slow settling of God's word in our hearts that helps transform us. And we see this in other categories of life. Think of a way you've seen yourself be sanctified. God's word was an essential part of that, and it took a while, and probably continues to take a while. But God's word has been essential in helping kind of train your attitudes. So passages out of Song of Solomon, right? It is good for a wife to soak her heart in realizing that it's good for her husband to delight in her body, and it's good for her to delight in her husband's body, and vice versa, right? Passages in Genesis, I didn't put exact references, but I'm thinking of Genesis chapter 1. There's plenty of other passages in Genesis on sex. You don't want to soak your heart in those. But Genesis 1, right? Or 1 Corinthians, the passage here in chapter 7 about sex is a good thing. It's one of the things that helps combat the devil's temptations in your marriage, according to the text. And another thing you can do as a survivor is pay attention to what things open up your desires for sexual intimacy. Okay, every human being is kind of wired slightly differently in terms of the things that make you wake up towards desiring sex with your spouse. Pay attention to your thoughts. Pay attention to what your spouse says, what your spouse does that kind of cultivates or stokes the fires a little bit, and then communicate that with them. For the I have ally here, that's just a short way of saying survivor spouse, ally spouse. Meditate on your responsibility to care primarily for your spouse. Philippians 2, 2-11, Romans 14, 13-23, and be content without grumbling, right? Your desire is to benefit your spouse, not simply gratify our own sexual desires. So two, first is retraining your thoughts and affections. Second is retraining your body. Okay, now many of the struggles that we indicated above that couples face are related to trauma. Now this is another word that has an enormous range that it's used in. I'm using it in a traumatic event style. This is not someone glared at me meanly, so therefore they traumatized me. This is more, I'm looking at the biological impact of trauma. Biological and mental impact of trauma here, okay? So we don't have time to walk through all of that, but when something like sexual abuse happens, it has a significant impact upon our physical bodies and our neurology. And we're really good as a church of talking about spiritual things, but we can sometimes lack an understanding of what this does biologically to us. So an example of this would be the stereotypical example of a veteran diving to the ground when there's a door that slams or a car that backfires, right? What's happening is that that's not necessarily a voluntary decision. Their body has been trained to respond to certain noises for the sake of their own preservation. And the reason it looks weird is because they're not in Afghanistan or Iraq or Vietnam anymore. That's an entirely reasonable act inside those environments. It's an unreasonable act in a different environment, but that happens pre-decision-making. It's the instantaneous fight-flight response. What do I do, right? That happens in sexual abuse. So I have a few different categories here that would be helpful for you to think through as you think through sex with your spouse. Okay, there are particular things that serve as triggers for spouses who have been abused. Stepping away from sexual abuse for a second, I'm dealing with this with some of these right now. Where I mentioned I was in that car accident with the deer. For me, driving at night through my South Carolina rural roads is really triggering for me, especially when I see stuff moving out of my peripheries, right? Like, after I drive, I have to go home and use a back massager because my muscles are involuntarily tightened up every time I drive to, like, painful degrees. I'm not afraid of hitting another deer. Chances of it happening are very low. I bought a large enough vehicle that will obliterate any deer that I hit again. At my wife's demand, right? No Prius for me, Bo. right? And yet, there's still... But I don't... I haven't faced that at all driving around your roads here. No problem whatsoever. It's really urban. Well, semi-urban, right? And there's not deer crawling around here. It's just a different environment. There's no triggers, okay? So, these are categories that you want to think through when it comes to sex with your spouse. Time of day, right? If someone was abused by their father at midnight, consistently growing up, is sex at midnight likely to have a higher chance of triggering than sex at 4 p.m.? Yes. Think through time of day. The amount of light in a room. I had a friend co-wrote a little book with her. And for her and her husband, they discovered after she married her husband that having sex with him in a dark room was a catalyst for all kinds of panic attacks. Why? Because she was raped on the mission field multiple times in entirely dark rooms. So what did they do? Arizona sunrise every single time they had sex with each other. That's helpful, right? Location, a bedroom, a couch, discreet location outside. There are certain places that may be more triggering than others. The feel of certain fabrics, right? If someone was raped on a pair of flannel sheets, it could be that the feel of flannel fabric triggers a biological memory, just the same way that a door slam triggers a gunshot memory inside a war veteran, or a certain scent. I have a friend who struggles with a particular brand of laundry detergent, right? What would it be like if your face was pressed into a pillow that smelled a certain way when you were sexually assaulted, right? All of these things are categories for thinking through potential triggers. And to the best of your ability, it's really wise to consider how to arrange your environment to decrease these amount of triggers, right? If you need to rearrange the furniture in your house, rearrange the furniture in your house. If you need to not have sex in a bedroom anymore, but to have it on the couch, have sex on the couch, right? Now, these things aren't necessarily always durable. Talked about my friend who was raped. She eventually was able to decrease slowly the amount of light in the bedroom and is totally fine now, right? But what happened? What needed to happen was for there to be new memories layered over the old memories to the point that her memories with her husband now replaced the memories and responses from that. Okay. Second is your bodies. So your body and your spouse's body are also part of the equation as possible hindrances and possible helps. The goal is to be helpful towards the surviving spouse. So just some other categories. Foreplay. Right? There's certain forms of just playfully aggressive foreplay that might trigger memories or feelings of assault. And so, it's helpful not to do them. Clothing. What do you wear? How much do you wear? Who takes off whose clothing? These things can be triggering kind of events. What's helpful, what's not? And it's important for the abuse survivor to pay attention to this, as they're the one who will know. Certain sexual positions. There are certain sexual positions that may either trigger particular memories of the assault or lead to fewer feelings of control. Right? For the surviving spouse. It may be helpful for certain sexual positions not to be used for the sake of the care of the surviving spouse. Certain words. For example, if an abuser would consistently say, "You're amazing," at the end of it, a spouse is the survivor's spouse should probably purge those words out of there, as those can be triggering of, "Well, that's exactly what my abuser said." Now, again, realize that this is kind of not subconscious in the weird way, but just an understanding of how human beings are wired. Our bodies matter, and we have certain patterns that matter. And so we're simply thinking of ways to help reduce the number of triggers. And a note to the spouse of survivors. Recognize that there are, when you marry your spouse, you marry their narrative. And because of that, it may mean that you give up certain things that are entirely permissible before God's law that you might enjoy, right? It could be that for sex, for you and your spouse, for 40 years, you only use one sexual position. And maybe you'd like a little bit of variety, but it triggers her or it triggers him. What does it mean to love your spouse? It could be that, you know, certain types of foreplay are something that you really enjoy. The goal is to care for your spouse. You know, Romans 14 is written about food and idols, but there's a little verse tucked away in there that we can paraphrase Paul. Paul says, do not destroy your brother or sister for the sake of food. And we can likewise say, do not destroy your spouse for the sake of your particular preferences in sex. Right? And for the survivor, well, we'll get that in a second. Okay, C, your plan. Now, I've found, and those that I've talked with about such things that also do this kind of counseling, we found that most couples benefit from having a plan. Okay, so what do you do? Like, all this is kind of good, kind of new stuff, but how do you actually start walking forward in this? Well, sex, if you're thinking of music, sex is, like, great sex is kind of like jazz, where it's spontaneous. But sometimes, let's see, but jazz musicians have to have a really thorough understanding of music theory in order to play decent jazz, right? And so you need, in many ways, you need to learn to play the piano not jazz before you learn to play the piano jazz. There has to be an understanding of how chord structures work, of how rhythms work. And so sometimes couples need to start perhaps with classical music sex versus jazz sex. And that's not saying listen to that type of music. It's saying, right, just as the metaphor there, right? People understand things in misunderstand things in interesting ways, right? I'm a professor. Read the syllabus is my usual response to such questions of misunderstanding. So incremental progress. You know, sex is more than just intercourse. Sex is all kinds of things leading up to intercourse. It's part of the sexual process between a husband and a wife. And I've found that oftentimes couples do well by working in increments. Sometimes couples simply need to start by sitting and cuddling on the couch together, fully clothed, his arm around her. You know what? If the last time she was touched by a man, she was pinned to the ground and raped, maybe sitting with your arm around your spouse for 2 minutes is a big win. You see different kind of progress here. Sitting closely or cuddling on the couch, kissing, laying together in bed while unclothed, a sensual massage, whether partially clothed or unclothed, that doesn't lead to sex. Sex with a survivor in control of the situation. You know, when you come to your plan, it's helpful to plan out what to do. That way the survivor knows that there's not going to be kind of an aberration here. They can plan on what's going to happen. So plan, be as concrete as you need to be for the sake of the surviving spouse. You know, where are we going to have sex? When are we going to have sex? What kind of sex are we going to have? What positions are we going to use? What are we going to do to ramp up towards sex? How long are we going to do this? It's helpful to have a safe word for the survivor to say if things need to stop, right? You can have a good plan, and especially if you're starting to try and move in incremental ways, what's a safe word that they can say to say we need to stop right now? And if someone needs to stop, well, the ally needs to seek to serve their spouse. It can be hard to stop in the middle of sex, especially as things ramp up in passion. But remember, your goal is to serve your spouse. If they need to take a little break, get them a cup of tea, a snack, water, whatever they deem helpful. If a survivor is having kind of strong dissociations, things like holding an ice cube or naming items in the room can be helpful. And if it gets violent, protect yourself, protect your spouse, and then you probably need to go and seek some significant help from a trauma-informed counselor. As you kind of work through this, it's important for you to celebrate the wins that happen, right? It's important to celebrate wins. If you made it to maybe step 3 on the incremental thing, that's a win. If next time you only make it to 2, that might be a little disappointing, but it's also a win, right? And lastly, remember that a plan is a plan, it's not a promise, right? The surviving spouse, it can be tempting to say, well, we planned this, and you said that we were going to have sex at 7 p.m. tonight. And I've been looking forward to this all day long. Well, sometimes a surviving spouse can just get to 7 o'clock and say, you know what? I wanted to, but right now I'm not ready. You know what you can do? Love your spouse well by prioritizing them. So I know there's some more notes that we didn't necessarily walk through here. I did want to give you a couple or three suggested resources. These are three works that I found to be particularly helpful. I'm biased towards the first one because I wrote half of it, right? It's a little mini book. Some of you noted, wow, there's a lot of notes here. Well, there's a lot of notes because this is a book turned into an hour talk. A little mini book, Help Our Sex Life is Troubled by Past Abuse. That's by me and a sexual abuse survivor who's also a master's grad biblical counselor. It expands on it. That would be a helpful starting spot. There's another book out there called The Great Sex Rescue, which is a great title for a book, let's be honest. So that's a book that is more detailed in terms of some of the mechanics of sex, but also works to deconstruct some really strange teaching on sex, pornography, sexual desires, and things like that. Just a couple comments. One, they're not complementarians. And you'll see them take a swipe at complementarians a couple times. Two, they're not reformed. And you'll see a chapter where they start talking about how God doesn't cause us to love him, and if he does, because any kind of forced love is rape. Okay, overlook it. That's not essential to the message of the text, of what they're talking about here. And part of just being a wise Christian is to be able to say, this whole thing is really helpful, and that's not helpful, but I'm going to look at this. Okay? And three would be this book by Douglas Rosno. It's a celebration of sex. This one's about 350 pages long, and it's the kind of book that has a whole lot of drawings in it, and the kind of book that you're probably not going to read cover to cover. It's written by a medical doctor and a helpful resource for you and your spouse if you're struggling with some of the more mechanics of how to help each other feel pleasure. So three kind of sources there. Thank you guys for this. It's been good to talk about, and I hope for those of you that struggle that the Lord uses this to help you experience some of the delights of God's gift. Sometimes God's gift of sex has some assembly required on it. And you know what? That's not a bad thing. All right. Thanks, friends.